move to the third case this morning, Soom Kim v. Carters, Inc. Mr. Kenyon? Mr. Lubin.
May it please the Court, Peter Lubin. I represent the plaintiffs in this case. This case is about Carter's Children's Clothing Stores masquerading its 200 outlet stores as discount stores. They bombard their customers with promises of exceptional savings on the signs, which are clear, definite, and explicit, and they promise these exceptional savings to the customers. Carter's accomplishes, and none of the discounts are delivered to the customers. The customers do not get the promised discounts. Carter's accomplishes this consumer fraud, which this court in the first Sandfield and second Sandfield case is a fraud, statutorily defined in Illinois, by pre-ticketing all of the items in its stores with a Carter's suggested price that Carter's never actually sells the products at, and then is able to advertise exceptional discounts that are completely fictitious. In this case, it's our position that the district court erred by not accepting as true the well-pled allegations in the complaint. And the key allegations in both plaintiffs' complaints are paragraphs 26 through 28. The most important case when I looked at alleging proper damages is the Sandfield 1 decision of this court, footnote number 8. And what that court said is, what the court, this court said in that opinion is, it is a deceptive practice to do exactly what Carter's did. It's a fraudulent practice. Then the question becomes, were the consumers actually deceived and damaged? And ultimately in the Sandfield 2 decision, the court said that the jewelry store plaintiff, it wasn't a consumer plaintiff, couldn't put on any credible evidence that consumers were actually deceived and didn't purchase from the plaintiff jeweler as a result of this fraudulent practice, and therefore the plaintiff lost. In this case, in paragraphs completely different than Sandfield, in this case, in paragraphs 26 through 28, the complaints explicitly and directly allege that the plaintiffs believed the deceptive advertising. They didn't know Carter's prices were fictitious. They believed that they were getting exceptional discounts and that they purchased the clothing as a direct result of the deception. That is exactly the damages and the deceit that the Sandfield opinion in footnote 8, the first Sandfield opinion, says is required to plead an actionable consumer fraud claim. The breach of contract is clear and simple there. There was a price-setting mechanism set by clear, definite, and explicit advertising that all the consumer had to do was accept it. That advertising said you're going to get exceptional discounts based on Carter's manufacturer's suggested price, which by definition under Illinois law must be the price at which the product is regularly sold in the trade area, which the complaint said was not true. Carter's never sold its products at those manufacturers' suggested prices. So the consumers, so Carter's didn't use the contractually agreed upon price setting mechanism. It didn't use a true manufacturer's suggested price. It breached the contracts by using a fictitious price so that it could promise consumers exceptional discounts, which were never delivered. The damages are the consumers did not get the promised exceptional discounts. They were promised a price below the regular market price. They believed and went into these stores, and the complaints allege, and it must be credited as true on a motion to dismiss, that they were actually deceived and believed they were buying products for less than they were actually worth. That's why people go to manufacturers' outlet stores. Now, in the Sandfield case, that's jewelry. Consumers often know that that may be puffing, and apparently the plaintiff actually on an evidentiary record when it came back on remand and went up again, they couldn't put on any evidence that any consumers were deceived. Now, the district court also relied on a recent Illinois appellate decision, the Mulligan decision. That also involved jewelry, and it involved QVC. And the district court found that for a plaintiff to be damaged, the product has to be worth less than the customer paid for it. That, we believe, is not the holding of Mulligan. Mulligan was very unique on its facts, and again, unlike this case, went up to the court, the Illinois Appellate Court, on an evidentiary record. In that case, Mulligan, and it's a slightly different deceptive pricing practice. It was comparing retail prices to the price that QVC sold its jewelry at. And in that case, the plaintiff testified that she was not deceived by QVC's practices. She said that she didn't believe the prices that QVC was holding out to be the regular retail prices and didn't believe she was getting an exceptional discount. She said the bargain that she thought she was getting from QVC was that they charged her a fair price. And the evidence in that case showed that QVC, in fact, charged her a fair price. So she wasn't looking for a below-market price under her testimony. She was looking only to get the price that the products regularly sell at in the marketplace. The court could have simply said in that case, you don't have a claim because you got your bargain and you weren't deceived. They went on to say that she wasn't damaged in dicta because her subjective belief, it wasn't really a contract, QVC advertised this giant spread between the retail prices in the marketplace and its price it was selling at, but she said she didn't believe any of that. What she said was she subjectively believed that she was going to get a price that was a fair price. The court said that's what you got, so you weren't damaged as well, and so you don't have a case. Our case is much more similar to the Affronti case of the Illinois Appellate Court and the Terrell case. In Affronti, the car dealer in that case advertised the car. I don't remember the exact price, but let's just say hypothetically, they advertised it at $7,500. The customer came in, there was no sticker on the car, and the customer asked, what is the price of this car, and what is the sticker price? And they said $8,500, and then they sold it to him at a much higher price than the advertised price. And the appellate court said that is consumer fraud. Misrepresenting the base price to get someone to pay a higher price is a consumer fraud. In the Terrell case, Hilton misrepresented to hotel customers the actual final cash register price of the hotel room by inflating the tax line item in the bill, and the customer paid a higher price because of the deception regarding the price, and the appellate court found that that stated both a breach of contract claim and a consumer fraud claim. And when Hilton raised similar defenses, although statutory voluntary payment as opposed to common law voluntary payment, to those raised by Carter's, the appellate court said Hilton didn't understand the concept of corporate accountability, and you can't make price misrepresentations to customers to achieve a higher price. When there is deception, there is damage. And the complaint at paragraphs 26 and 28, both complaints, specifically says that in the case of Kim, Kim did not know that Carter's never sells Carter's brand products at Carter's retail stores at Carter's suggested price. She didn't know in paragraph 27 that they never sell it in substantial volume, and that she purchased the products in paragraph 28 of the complaint because she was deceived and as a direct result of the deception. The measure of damages here is also her deception. The deception and damages are equal. When you don't get the benefit of your bargain, you are, by definition, under Hornbrook contract law, damaged. I reserve the rest of my time for if there's no question.
Did you make a nominal damage argument at the district court?
Did we? I think we're not going to pursue, because we believe there's damages here. We won't pursue a nominal damage claim. But I think you can just read the complaint and see that it alleges exactly what the practices are. And accepting the complaint's allegations as true, you can have a nominal damage claim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Mark Spock. I represent Carters, Inc., the appellee in this case. Your Honors, there are two types of claims in this case, a common law contract and the ICFA. The District Court properly dismissed both of those claims, Your Honor, because as alleged, on the complaints as alleged, there's no breach of the contract and there's no injury, and that applies to both of those types of claims. What's alleged is alleged by illustration. We don't have specific instances of purchases that are alleged because they're not identified. But the illustration goes like this, starting with the contract claim. These are goods, toddler T-shirts, that Carter's manufactures, that plaintiffs purchased at Carter's outlet stores. They're available from other retailers, but here, Carter's outlet stores. The T-shirts are on racks. The T-shirts have tags on each one that say Carter's suggested price. And in each case, the tag also has a stated dollar amount. In the example, the illustration that the plaintiffs provide, it's $16. Plaintiff goes to the rack, selects a T-shirt, decides that she's interested, looks up at the rack and sees a sign. There are two types of signs that the plaintiff will see, and that's what's alleged. Sometimes it's a fixed dollar amount, say in our example, $10. She goes to the register, presents the T-shirt. The cashier rings up the amount that Carter's wants to be paid in order to relinquish the shirt to the customer. It's $10. That's what's rung up. Same as the sign. Other times, the sign that will be on top of the rack will say a percentage off, say in the example, 30% off. Each tag, as I said, has not just Carter's suggested price, but a specific dollar amount. So it's the same scenario. The customer's interested, goes to the register, presents the T-shirt. The cashier rings up the amount that Carter's wants the customer to pay to walk out with the shirt. It's $11.20, 30% off of $16. If the plaintiff, in either of those cases, at that point decides to go ahead, the plaintiff and Carter's execute a purchase contract. The T-shirt for $10 or $11.20, whatever the price is, that's been rung up on the register, customer pays and walks out. Performance is immediate and complete. That's the contract, Your Honors. The plaintiff now says, months and years later, no, that's not the agreed price. Plaintiffs point to the use of the phrase suggested price on the tags and signs in the stores saying savings are available and argues that that overrides the $10 on the fixed amount sign, even though it's on the sign, rung up at the register, paid without objection in order to take the shirt out the store. The district court properly held that's not the case. The district court properly held you construe the contract according to its plain and ordinary terms and properly held it here. The agreed price was $10, and that's the contract. As to the second situation, where the sign says 30% off, it's the same situation. The plaintiff is charged $11.20, 30% off of the $16 on the tag. And the plaintiff says, no, but that the contract there was that it was supposed to be 30% off of whatever Carter's actual regular price for the T-shirt might be. The court, so they're saying it's not the amount that was actually stated on the tag, but something else. And the court says, properly, that runs afoul of the rule that you construe a contract according to its plain and ordinary terms. In Judge Kendall's words, to find that the sign means 30% off of an undisclosed actual regular price strains common sense when the customer is presented with an actual dollar amount on the sales tag. At the register, that's what Carter's agreed to sell the goods for, 30% off of the stated $16 on the tag, and the plaintiffs got that discount. So there's no breach, as alleged, as Judge Kendall properly found. There are several other grounds why the breach of contract claim should be dismissed. The plaintiffs say that despite Judge Kendall's ruling, the plain and ordinary meaning shouldn't prevail because the contract should be rewritten as a matter of public policy to incorporate the terms of FTC and Illinois regulations. There are three simple responses to that, Your Honors. No court has ever so held. Despite all of the regulatory enforcement actions cited in the brief, going back to the 60s, the plaintiffs cite no case where the regs have been held to give rise to a private contract claim. And we have found that in our research. And there's good reason for that. Second point. There's good reason for that. The regulations that he's citing, as framed, regulate advertising and solicitation, not the purchase contract itself. Plaintiff cites a series of insurance cases to support his argument on this point. But those cases are different because there the actual Illinois statutes provided that insurance policies could not be offered, sold, or issued without the coverage at issue. It regulated the contracts. Here, the regulations are different. The regulations he's talking about don't restrict the sale of goods, don't restrict the prices that can be agreed upon. What they regulate, what they address, is the advertising. If you look at the language of the regs, it talks about advertising. It talks about advertising claims. Claims is a term of art when you're talking about advertising. It's the advertising. So they're different. The third point I wanted to make in response is that independently, we've cited the cases, advertising and solicitation has long been considered not a part of the ultimate contract. And we've cited the Talbert case and the Villasenor case for that. It's on pages 12 and 13 of our brief. So what the plaintiff is really arguing here is that the advertising suggested to the plaintiffs that they would have to pay more elsewhere, that prices for these goods elsewhere would be more than what she could get the goods at the Carter's retail stores, Carter's outlet stores, and that induced the plaintiffs to enter into the contract. But the contract claim is on the contract itself, not the reasons for the plaintiff deciding to enter into the contract. Here, she still got the actual T-shirt she wanted. There's no defect at all that's alleged. And again, no court has ever held that the advertising regs become incorporated in the way that the plaintiffs are suggesting. The second ground for dismissal of the contract count still is the absence of any actual damage. It is independent of the first, so the court doesn't even need to reach it, but it does apply not just to the contract count, but to the ICFA count as well, which I'll get to in a moment. Again, Judge Kendall got it right. For any claim under contract, you need injury, actual damage. That's black-letter law. It's the same for the ICFA. For the ICFA, it's statutory. And here, there is no injury. The plaintiff got the T-shirt she wanted. There's no defect alleged. So what do you need for injury in that context? As Judge Kendall recognized, Mulligan tells you. Mulligan analyzes what injury is in this kind of a consumer purchase contract. The rule is where you make no claim that you paid more than the value of the clothing you received, you have no actual damage. Remember, there's no defect alleged. She got the T-shirt she wanted to get. So you never get to calculating benefit of the bargain damages because you have no injury to start with. The plaintiff says, I didn't get the savings that I thought I would get, but plaintiffs cite no case finding that to be a contractual injury. As Mulligan observed, there is no authority, and I'm quoting, there is no authority allowing recovery for misrepresentation of savings in a consumer transaction. The court could find none. Especially here, years after the transactions, that would be a pure windfall, and that's why it's not cognizable. Plaintiffs make an effort to claim nominal damages now as well. Your Honor, as we pointed out in our briefs, that wasn't raised below. It's been waived. But in any event, even if the court were to consider it, it's not available on a contract count, not available on any count, because to get nominal damages, you have to show injury in the first place. You only get to the damages part if you can establish the elements of your claim. If the elements of your claim include injury, you have to show that. You can't say, I'll waive damages, and therefore that's sufficient to satisfy the injury element of my cause of action. That doesn't work, and we've cited the cases in our brief, both in the contract section and in the ICFA section that address that. So after contract, what's left? Only the ICFA claim. And there are two counts. It's pled on a fairness basis and a deception basis. But it's both counts are under the ICFA. And even if there were noncompliance here with the reg, even if that were the case, the plaintiffs, those counts are dismissible and were properly dismissed because the plaintiffs do not have any cognizable injury. The Mulligan case, which we've relied on in our briefs, that was decided on very similar facts by the Illinois Appeals Court, and that's dispositive. Under Mulligan, even if there were some violation of the reg itself, a private ICFA plaintiff must still have injury. The statute specifically mandates actual damage as an element for proceeding. And here what's happened. The plaintiff paid money in exchange for certain goods. The plaintiffs got the clothes they wanted. There's no defect alleged. The only alleged misrepresentation for the ICFA claim is as to the savings. Mulligan says that isn't actual damage. What you need is actual pecuniary loss. And here, and what the court held is that unless you claim the goods were not worth what you paid, then there's no cognizable injury allowing you to sue. In Mulligan's word, that case involved QVC. The court said even if QVC's alleged inflated retail values may have induced Mulligan into altering her purchasing decision, because of the represented bona fide savings, she suffered no actual pecuniary loss. That's what we have here, because even now there's no allegation that the goods that the plaintiffs received were worth less than what she paid for them. Sandfield absolutely confirms the decision below, because Sandfield was a case where there were two decisions, came up to this court twice. And the first time the court had the end result of the of a trial below was that the court found there was a violation of the ICFA, but the court said the plaintiff hadn't proven damages. I take that back. There was a violation of the consumer regulations, of the regulations that the plaintiff was, of the advertising regulations. But the court said violation of the advertising regulations isn't enough. You need to show damage as well. And the plaintiff in that case didn't show it. That was a competitor case, not a consumer case. That was a situation. It involved a Lanham Act claim as well. It was one jewelry store saying they were being injured because another jewelry store was using advertising practices that were in violation of the statute. Here, you have a consumer claim. And I go back to what Mulligan observed in its decision. There's no court could find no authority allowing recovery for a misrepresentation of savings in a consumer transaction. So this court doesn't need to address whether there is a violation of the advertising regs, because even if there is, there's no injury sufficient to permit suit under the ICFA in any event. And I can respond to the point that counsel made. Yes, there was an independent ground for dismissal in Mulligan as well. The court also held independently that the plaintiff in that case said it was shown that she would have purchased the goods anyway. It was no deception in that case. But if you look at the Mulligan decision, it's absolutely clear these are two independent grounds, and the ground relating to lack of injury has nothing to do with the absence of deception in that case. The plaintiffs also try to salvage their claims with alleging nominal injuries here. Again, with respect to the ICFA claim, there's case law on this, specifically the Zydakis case, making it clear that there are some cases out there that used to allow nominal damages for the ICFA, but the Zydakis decision below clarified the law in that respect, took the law back to where it belongs, pointed out that the statute requires actual damage, and without it, you don't get to nominal damages. The Kirkpatrick case we've cited is consistent with that. They allowed it, but only because the plaintiff there had shown actual damage. The same reason, without injury, you don't get to punitives, and you don't get to injunctive relief without the damage. The case, the Affronti case that counsel cited, is just not appropriate. It also doesn't apply. In that case, the plaintiff didn't get the goods for the advertised price. Here, the plaintiff did. It's $10 or the discount off of $16. And what they paid was, what they got was goods that were worth less than the $8,600 that they paid. They paid $86. They were saying, this car is only obviously worth $69. Here, that's not our situation. Plaintiff makes no claim like that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time? You have 5 minutes, Mr.
As Judge Easterbrook found in the second Sandfield decision, this case involves serious fraudulent practices. These are unfair trade practices that harm consumers and harm competitors, and they're no different from price fixing. Two manufacturers of pop got together and fixed the price of pop, the consumer would go and pay at the cash register the agreed upon price, but the consumer would still be damaged because of the secret price fix. Here we have a secret breach of contract. That's what we had in Terrell. That's what you had in Affronti. The consumer is told that this particular price fixing mechanism is going to be used in the advertising. We're not talking about some untraditional, new, novel approach to contract law. We're talking about a contract being created by clear, explicit, and definite advertising that's capable of acceptance. A big sign in the Carter's store, 30% off. The consumer simply doesn't know, just like with a price fix product, that Carter's has secretly inflated and created a fictitious regular price. So the consumer's not getting 30% off, they're getting 0% off, because Carter's always sells the product at 30% off. This isn't a representation about what they could pay elsewhere. This is someone coming into a Carter's store. There's a big giant sign saying 40% off. The reason Carter's is using that sign and the reason the law finds the practice to be deceptive is it works. It deceives customers. They believe they're getting a great deal, 40% off. If Carter's thought that was a fair price, why would it need to use the deception? It would price the item at exactly the truthful price, and the consumer could do intelligent price shopping. The Mulligan decision does not deal with this fact pattern. The footnote 8 in Sandfield 1 does. There, the district court in the first Sandfield case made the same error that it is our position that was made by the district court here. The district court here said it strains common sense as to what the consumers believed. The district court didn't accept the allegations, the well-pled allegations in the complaint, that the two plaintiffs here were tricked. They believed the 40% off. They believed they were getting a below-market price. They believed they were getting a good deal, and they purchased the product. The deception is when there's damages. Mulligan, if you carefully look at the decision, it's not just about the fact that she wasn't deceived. The reason the plaintiff in Mulligan wasn't damaged was because the court said at page 1193, she thought the price she actually paid was a fair price. Here, the complaint says exactly the opposite. The plaintiffs believed people go to outlet stores because they believe that they're getting a heavily discounted price. They're not looking to buy the product at the price that a normal person would pay. They're not looking to just pay a fair price. That's why they go to the store. That's why Carter's bombards them with the advertisements of 40% off, which aren't true. The breach of contract is not using the agreed-upon price-setting mechanism. It's the same as the old cases we cited where you can have a piece of land, and if the land's worth $6,000 and you find out that there was less than represented in the advertising as far as acreage, you don't have any damages. But if you agreed to pay a certain price per acre and there's less land, then you are damaged. Here there was agreed upon price setting mechanism of 30% off the manufacturer's suggested price, which by law must be the price which it's regularly sold in the trade area. In this case, that was untrue. So the plaintiffs were damaged, and they did suffer injury. In the Affronti case, there's no allegation that the advertised price was the market price or the car was worth it, what it was paid for. That simply wasn't in the record there. They could have used a loss leader price in the advertisement that was below market price, and the plaintiff there still could have been damaged for the car they purchased. The issue wasn't raised there.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.